Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 1st, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi, and that's no joke. In today's weather, the Dubuque area will have mostly sunny skies with a high of 41 and a low of 24. On the front page of today's Telegraph Herald is an article by Benjamin Fisher titled, Counties Plan for Vaccine Increases. Area officials say they could use even more doses than they expect to receive. Area health officials are pleased to hear of increased COVID-19 vaccine shipments, but they do not think those increases will be enough to vaccinate the ideal percentage of the population anytime soon. Word from the federal government to states that more doses of vaccine are coming inspired Iowa and Wisconsin to open up qualifying for vaccination to all of their residents, and those increases are coming. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday that the state will get nearly 120,000 doses of vaccine next week, plus 45,800 doses that will be distributed via pharmacies through the Federal Retail Pharmacy Program. That will result in big percentage increases for some area counties. Dubuque County, through February and March, has been receiving regular weekly allotments of 2,340 doses of the vaccines, as decided by the Iowa Department of Public Health. According to members of the Dubuque County COVID-19 Incident Management Team, the county's allotment for next week will be 3,910 doses, an increase of 1,570, or 67%. While county public health leaders said any increase is good, each official also said they could handle more. Quote, even though it's a more than 50% increase from previous weeks, we could use 150%, said Dubuque County Health Department Director Patrice Lambert. Clayton County has been receiving 400 doses per week. Next week, the state says the county's allotment will more than double to 900. Delaware County has been receiving just 200 doses per week. Next week, health officials there have been told they will receive an additional 100, but those additional doses will still be reserved for its vulnerable population. Jackson County did not have numbers when reached on Wednesday. City of Dubuque Public Health Specialist Mary Rose Corrigan said the increased amount is still not enough to change projections of when a high enough percentage of the population vaccinated will turn the tide of the pandemic. Quote, this small increase is not going to change the course of us being done sometime in midsummer, she said. Stacy Killian, administrator of Unity Point's Visiting Nurse Association, contracted Public Health Department for Clayton County, said the 900 doses next week are well within the provider's capacity to administer there. Delaware County Public Health Manager Charity Luck said that her county has never received near the number of doses that providers there could handle. She said that the 100 additional doses they will get next week, being reserved for a targeted population, seems like no increase at all. Quote, we've not seen an increase in vaccine until this week, she said, and there wasn't an increase for the general public per se. We have the capability of doing much more, end quote. In Wisconsin, Grant County Public Health Director Jeff Kindre announced in a press release Wednesday that his county would receive an increase in doses along with their state opening qualifications on Monday, April 5th. Quote, if vaccination goes well and people are careful through May, it might be enough to make our summer more pleasant and with much less illness, he said. While county health departments are itching for more doses, Iowa is opening up qualification for the vaccines as of Monday, April 5th. Reynolds acknowledged in a press conference Wednesday that opening will not equate to sudden access for folks who did not previously qualify. Quote, expanding eligibility opens the opportunity for more Iowans to be vaccinated, she said. It also means more Iowans will be vying for the vaccine appointments as they become available. Even though the amount of vaccine is increasing, there still will not be enough doses to vaccinate everyone immediately, end quote. Corrigan said that in Dubuque County, the incident management team has 1,300 prioritized essential workers yet to begin vaccinations. So she said those individuals will continue to be the team's focus. Other than that, though, all residents 16 and older qualify. To handle the increased appointments, the Dubuque County team pitched a second vaccination site at Grand River Center in Dubuque. That will come with a direct line for residents to call, which a person will answer to schedule appointments. Quote, it's going to help our residents immensely, Lambert said. Quote, the state's 211 has always had the vaccine navigators, but they are totally overwhelmed, end quote. That line will not be up and running next week. The Dubuque County Board of Supervisors had planned to vote on a resolution or memorandum of understanding with the City of Dubuque to open the site and phone line on Monday. Officials expect set up to take at least 1 week. In the meantime, Corrigan said providers will continue to contact their patients in order of vulnerability. Quote, what people don't understand is they're also responsible for giving their boosters after 3 weeks or 4 weeks, Lambert added. Killian said Clayton County will have a similar line, which she expects to go live at least by Monday, April 5th. Corrigan and Kendre both urged the public to continue practicing preventative measures, wearing masks, avoiding large gatherings, social distancing, until most of the population is vaccinated. The City of Dubuque, Dubuque County, and Iowa are currently seeing increases in positive cases. IDPH Director Kelly Garcia, during Wednesday's conference, blamed much of the statewide uptick to people traveling over spring breaks. On the front page of today's Telegraph Herald is a photograph of Steve Shadler as he attaches a step to one of the rail cars at Fenelon Place Elevator in Dubuque on Wednesday. The elevator opens today, Thursday, April 1st, and will run daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. In another front page article, Kaylee Reese of the Telegraph Herald reports, jury finds Ellison guilty of lesser charge. After nearly a day of deliberation, a Dubuque County jury found a man guilty of a lesser charge for a fatal shooting last year on Loras Boulevard. Deontay W.B. Wilson, age 26, was found guilty of manslaughter on Wednesday during his trial at the Dubuque County Courthouse. Ellison shot Curtis R. Smothers Jr., age 25, on July 2nd after an argument escalated into a fight. While prosecutors argued that Ellison intended to kill Smothers, defense attorneys argued that Ellison was acting in self-defense. Ellison originally was charged with first-degree murder, a conviction that would have carried an automatic sentence of life in prison without parole. Instead, he now faces a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. After the trial, defense attorneys Ben Bartles and Natalia Blaskovich both told the Telegraph Herald that they were pleased with what they called a, quote, just, end quote, verdict. Quote, we felt from the get-go that Ellison was clearly overcharged, Blaskovich said. The defense attorneys said for a killing to be first-degree murder, it must meet several qualifications, such as premeditation, deliberation, and intent to kill. A voluntary manslaughter charge stems from an act done in, quote, the heat of passion, end quote. Quote, the evidence clearly shows this was a chance encounter from our client's perspective, Bartle said. Quote, this never should have been first-degree murder, end quote. In response to a call seeking comment from the Telegraph Herald, County Attorney C.J. May III emailed a statement that said in part, quote, the Office of the Dubuque County Attorney accepts the jury's verdict and respects the work of the members of the jury, the court, and the legal process as a whole in this matter. We appreciate the efforts of local law enforcement in their investigation of this case. End quote. Both the prosecution and defense made their closing arguments in the week-long trial on Tuesday. May argued that Ellison intended to kill Smothers, while the defense said Ellison was acting in self-defense. Jurors were shown the traffic camera footage capturing the incident numerous times throughout the trial. On July 2nd, Smothers can be seen exiting a vehicle on Loras Boulevard to greet his daughter, who ran to and hugged him. The girl was with her mother, Vanessa Ellison, who is now married to and shares two children with Deontay Ellison. Trial testimony revealed that Smothers was violating a no-contact order by approaching Vanessa Ellison and her family. Smothers pleaded guilty to a charge of domestic abuse in 2015 after slapping Vanessa Ellison. Quote, from our client's perspective, there was his wife that was supposed to be protected by a protective order, and here comes her abuser up to her. Here comes an abuser up to his family, Blaskovich said. Quote, the police didn't even look into the fact that this protective order was in place, and that's on a system readily available to them, end quote. Traffic camera footage showed Deontay Ellison and Smothers get into an argument and fight. Ellison then fired his gun at Smothers, who twisted out of the way. The second shot Ellison fired struck Smothers in his chest, and he was later pronounced dead at the hospital. Ellison ran into a nearby residence right after the shooting, but he left it before police responding to the incident set up a perimeter after learning of his location. He eventually made his way to Michigan with his wife and their children. He was arrested by the U.S. Marshals Service in Kalamazoo after a 12-day manhunt. Quote, "They didn't even consider any of that perspective of self-defense," Blaskovich said. "They charged him so quickly that they didn't look into a lot of things," end quote. Ellison's sentencing hearing on the manslaughter charge is scheduled for May 3rd. Ellison already had a sentencing hearing scheduled May 3rd regarding a separate charge that stemmed from the July 2nd incident. Ellison previously entered a written plea of guilty for possession of a firearm by a felon. Another front page article is written by Jeff Montgomery, entitled "Pet Food Manufacturer Hires 120. A pet food manufacturing company opening a Dubuque facility already has hired more than 120 employees and remains on pace to start operations this summer. Simmons Pet Food issued a so-called progress update on Wednesday that said the company is on target to start production in the former Flex Steel Industries plant on Sipple Road in July. Simmons officials noted that staffing goals for the first phase of production are, quote, on target, end quote. Quote, "We are thrilled to see the progress being made over the last few months," said Scott Salmon, president of Simmons Pet Food, in a prepared statement. Quote, "Our engineering and operations teams are executing at a high level to ensure facility modifications are complete and process testing can begin as planned," end quote. The company in December announced plans to open the state-of-the-art canned pet food operation at 501 Sepple Road. Once the two-phase project is completed, the overall investment will total $80 million and Simmons will have more than 270 employees. Simmons Pet Food is a leading North American private label and contract manufacturer of wet and dry pet food and treats. In addition to Dubuque, it creates products at facilities located in Northwest Arkansas, Emporia, Kansas, and Ontario, Canada, according to the company's progress update. The company began recruiting for key leadership and support positions in January and then shifted its focus to supervisory roles, according to the company's update. Multiple job fairs were held in the past month to hire most of the remaining positions. With more than 120 people hired, Simmons is easily on pace to meet its goal of hiring 138 workers by the middle of 2021. Julie Moss, the company's director of communications, believes the successful recruiting effort was the result of collaboration and a boots-on-the-ground mentality. Quote, "We have had our HR teams on the ground from the very beginning," she said. "They began making those contacts and working directly with workforce development groups. The community has been very supportive of our hiring and recruiting efforts. These employees are receiving hands-on training at the Simmons plant in Emporia, Kansas, in hopes that they can hit the ground running once the Dubuque plant opens. Comprehensive work on the facility itself also has been taking place." Mouse said crews have constructed additional receiving space and cold storage areas. Workers also are conducting extensive utility and plumbing work in preparation for equipment installation. "Such modifications are necessary to make the facility conducive to pet food production." Quote, "This is a food manufacturing business," Moss said. Quote, "Obviously, it has very different electrical and plumbing needs than what the Flex Steel facility had needed," end quote. Local officials are pleased to see the large-scale project coming together. Rick Dickinson, president and CEO of Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, has been on site multiple times. Quote, "It is like a beehive of activity," Dickinson said. He emphasized that the flurry of development isn't just an encouraging sign of what's to come at the Simmons site. The project is also having an immediate positive impact on multiple local companies that are participating in the extensive work. Quote, "There is a ripple effect to projects like this," Dickinson said. "They have hired local trades, local engineering firms, and local developers. They have taken great pains to use our businesses in town as a resource," end quote. So far, everything remains on precisely the pace outlined by Simmons Pet Food. The company said Monday it plans to begin production in July, the same timetable put forth when Simmons first announced the project back in December. Dickinson added that the company is, quote, "ahead of schedule," end quote, when it comes to finding the necessary workers. Quote, "They have fulfilled every one of the promises they made and more," he said. Quote, "We have so many wonderful employers in town. They are proving to be another," end quote. Page 2 of the Telegraph Herald features news from Dubuque. In the News in Brief section, Dubuque man pleads guilty to 3 charges for sexual abuse of girl. A Dubuque man recently pleaded guilty to 3 charges related to the repeated sexual abuse of a girl over a 3-year period. Larry S. Doan, aged 61, entered a written guilty plea in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to 3 counts of lascivious acts with a child. As part of a plea deal, a 4th count of lascivious acts with a child and 1 count of second-degree sexual abuse will be dismissed. Court documents state Doan began the abuse of the girl, whom he knew in the summer of 2014 when the victim was younger than 12. The abuse continued until November 2017. The Telegraph Herald does not provide identifying information of victims of sexual crimes. Dubuque Police and the Dubuque County Department of Human Services launched their investigation in July 2019. Court documents state that prosecutors will argue that Doan should be sentenced to 30 years in prison, 10 years for each of the 3 counts, with the sentences running consecutively. Doan's attorneys will argue that all 3 sentences should run concurrently. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for May 3rd. Monticello school employee recognized for saving student. A Monticello Community School District employee has been recognized for her life-saving efforts. Connie Randolph, an associate at Carpenter Elementary School, received an award of recognition from the school board for performing the Heimlich maneuver on a choking student on March 11th, according to an online announcement. Quote, "Her quick response saved a life that day," the announcement stated. Today's Telegraph Herald reports 1 virus death in Dubuque County. There was 1 new death in Dubuque County between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. 22 more Dubuque County residents were confirmed to have COVID-19 during the 24-hour period. By 5 p.m. Wednesday, 61,291 residents in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area had been fully vaccinated, 20.3% of the population. Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.2% as of 5 p.m. Wednesday. Rates for other area Iowa counties were Clayton County, 1.5%, Delaware County, 5.6%, Jackson County, 4.9%, and Jones County, 3.9%. The state provided new county-level hospitalization data on Wednesday. As of Monday, there were 2 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 who were hospitalized, a decrease of 4 from Sunday. Jones County had 1 such resident hospitalized, the same as Sunday. Jackson County had 2 such residents hospitalized, an increase of 2 from Sunday. No such residents of Clayton and Delaware counties were hospitalized. Hartig Drug announced Wednesday it is administering the COVID-19 vaccine at all of its Iowa and Wisconsin locations through the Federal Pharmacy Partner Program. The pharmacy is also providing vaccines in most Illinois locations through state and local partnerships. Hartig is currently administering the Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, dependent on location. Residents of Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin can check their eligibility and schedule first dose appointments at hartigdrug.com/COVID-vaccine. Hy-Vee announced Wednesday that COVID-19 vaccine is now available in all Hy-Vee pharmacy locations across its 8-state region. The chain began administering vaccinations in Wisconsin this week through the Federal Retail Pharmacy Program. Appointments to receive the vaccine can be made at hy-v.com/COVID-vaccine. Scheduling for 2 Grant County vaccine clinics is now open. The first clinic will be held at the Grant County Fairgrounds on Wednesday, April 7th, and will administer the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. The second clinic will be held at the Broski Center in Platteville and will administer the Moderna vaccine. No date was provided on the county's Facebook page for the second clinic. To schedule an appointment, call 608-723-6416. In news in brief for the Tri-State region, Maquoketa City Council faces second vacancy this spring. The Maquoketa City Council will have a second vacancy to fill this spring. Second Ward Councilmember Jessica Keene recently announced that she and her family are moving out of the country. Keene was elected to the council in 2017. She announced that she plans to serve until mid-May. The council has 8 seats, the mayor, 2 at-large representatives, and 5 ward representatives. The council can fill Keene's upcoming vacancy by appointment or hold a special election. Erica Barker resigned from her position as the 3rd Ward Representative earlier this month. The council decided they would fill that position by appointment. Road construction projects near Lancaster moved up to 2022. Construction projects on 2 Wisconsin highways near Lancaster now are slated to start in the summer of 2022. They are among 42 projects being completed statewide through federal COVID-19 relief funding, according to a press release from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. The projects include resurfacing a 6-mile stretch of Wisconsin 35, which runs from McKinley Street in Lancaster and ends east of the Grant River Bridge. The project was initially slated for 2027. Wisconsin 35 is expected to remain open during construction with flagging operations on the highway, the release states. The other project, which was originally slated for 2023, will replace the bridge over Hackett Branch Stream. The bridge is located on Wisconsin 81, south of the Wisconsin 81-Wisconsin 35 intersection between Lancaster and B-Town. Wisconsin 81 will be closed at the bridge during construction, the release states, and traffic will be detoured to Wisconsin 133. Let's turn now to the opinion page of today's Telegraph Herald. It includes an Other View column written by Arthur Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. His column today is titled, North Korea Best Handled with Help of America's Allies. Once again, North Korea is engaging in disturbing provocation. On March 25th, the totalitarian regime in Pyongyang launched 2 missiles off the east coast. They flew 373 miles, according to the official news agency. Monitors in Japan put the range of the tests at 400 miles. This is the first such test in nearly a year. The last one took place on March 29th, 2020. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution prohibiting such tests. Separately, the UN Human Rights Commission has condemned the regime, a welcome move from that group. North Korea has had at least rudimentary nuclear weapons since 2006. From time to time, Pyongyang makes threats to use them, including against the United States, as well as Japan and South Korea. This latest incident occurs as the Biden administration reevaluates Korea policies. A natural assumption is that North Korea leader Kim Jong-un is returning to rigid hostility after some flexibility over the past 4 years, including high-profile meetings with President Donald Trump. In moving forward, the U.S. government officials should keep in mind 3 basic realities about dealing with North Korea. First, for many years, North Korea has been inconsistent. In 2013, Pyongyang declared a so-called state of war with South Korea and abruptly abrogated the 1953 armistice that ended the Korean War. Yet accommodating moves followed. In short, unpredictability is normal. This implies considerable factional infighting. Second, we must demonstrate commitment to defense of South Korea and our own readiness and willingness to use a range of forces. The Obama administration rightly deployed the THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Air Defense Anti-Missile System, for this purpose. In 2013, the Pentagon expanded anti-ballistic missile defenses on the U.S. West Coast. Simultaneously, THAAD was sent to Guam, a potential target. In 2009, THAAD was sent to Hawaii for the same reason. On cue, China expressed indignation about anti-missile deployments. That was predictable, also understandable, given potential use of the system's radars for information gathering. At the same time, Beijing worked to restrain Pyongyang, including suspending airline flights between the 2 cities. Third, we should emphasize coordination with other nations. This ideally should include China and Russia, but always our durable friend and close ally, South Korea. South Korea's substantial investment in and trade with China grows, while North Korea remains a costly dependent, though ideologically important. China's President Xi Jinping visited Seoul in 2014. He finally visited North Korea in 2019. China's foreign policy reflects self-interest and traditional caution regarding military force. North Korea is a drain and, over time, a source of growing, well-founded anxiety. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought North Korea's long-growing economic deterioration to a crisis point. Trade and wider interchange with China contracted. long-term economic sanctions stymie recovery. The frustrating Korean War from 1950 to 1953 devastated the Korean Peninsula and made the Cold War global. President Harry Truman's courageous decision to support the United Nations in defending the South against invasion from the North laid the foundation for today's remarkably successful Republic of Korea. Democratic change culminated with election in 1998 of President Kim Dae-jung, heroic opponent of dictatorship. In 2000, he received the Nobel Peace Prize. During the earlier dictatorship, Kim survived imprisonment and at least one attempt to kill him. Occasional political turmoil since 1998 confirms South Korea's democracy. As in the past, U.S. leaders should work with allies, underscore military commitment, and pursue negotiation. The Biden administration's deployment of traditional diplomacy is encouraging. Again, this is the opinion of Arthur Sear. In letters to the editor, Ryan T. Rieg of Golden Oaks Drive in Dubuque writes, "Small town life beats big city." I always wondered how a town of 57,882 people has received 5 recognition awards within 12 years as an All-America city. Sounds great, right? Except for the fact we will no longer be called a metropolitan city and be listed as micropolitan. I like those expressions, micro versus rat metro. I recognize we have crime and drug use, but I like less crime, less drug use, and smaller taxes, small town versus big city, that our community brings. They want more funding through grants. In the end, the taxpayers get the final tab. If the federal agencies of management and budget process this bill as expected, it would leave the offices of city manager, CEO of Greater Dubuque Development, and CEO of Chamber of Commerce with direct remarks such as, quote, "wipe Dubuque off the map," end quote. Quote, "either you're on the metro list or you're not," end quote. And, quote, "if we're not on the metro list, we're just flyover country," end quote. Parenthetical comment, these are direct quotes from the Telegraph Herald, March 10, 2021. Sounds like doomsday for Dubuquers. Bottom line, we don't need to give Fortune 500 companies, like IBM, $50 million in 2009. Parenthetical comment, city and state incentives, just to take advantage and leave 10 years later. Or $10.2 million for a furniture company, FlexSteel, to leave in less than 3 years. Maybe city leaders need to change. Unless an interstate goes through your community, you will always be an oversized Epworth. Love Epworth. But if you want big metro, then move there and see if the so-called status is all that great. Signed, Ryan T. Rieg of Golden Oaks Drive in Dubuque. Dwayne Blair of North Cascade Road in Dubuque writes, "Eliminating gun permits won't make people safer." How do Iowa representatives in Des Moines think that passing Senate File 535 or House File 756 will make people safe by allowing more people to purchase and carry firearms without a permit? The whole idea is ludicrous. They say it will protect more people, but to me, it's a free-for-all. I know a lot of individuals that aren't responsible enough to own a handgun. They react before they think. This is one thing that should have government oversight. This is why we have police officers. I realize they are still doing background checks, but that doesn't prove people's responsibility and how a person reacts in certain situations. And now the COVID-19 relief package is another thing to give people money. If I make $60,000 a year and I live within my means, I certainly don't need $1,400. It seems to be a free-for-all, and values and morals are slipping away. I'm glad I won't be around to see the outcome. Signed, Dwayne Blair of North Cascade Road in Dubuque. Paul Hemmer of Simpson Street in Dubuque writes, "Biden administration policies enabling crime." Those who watched the recent presidential press conference viewed a scripted event that demonstrably proved the diminishing mental state of the man occupying the most powerful position in the world. Where is the enthusiastic praise from our Democrat friends for the fabulous job Biden is doing? Perhaps they are too embarrassed to admit their error. They are indeed paying the same higher gas prices and notice the massive additions to the unemployment numbers. The invasion at our southern border created by Biden is criminal behavior by both the invaders and those allowing it to happen. The Biden administration is now complicit in child abuse, rape, and enabling the Mexican cartels to funnel drugs that will kill thousands and destroy families. Democrats said $5 billion for the wall was too expensive, but $155 billion a year to support them here illegally is a human right. Remember, you are paying for this just like the billions you are spending for non-COVID so-called pork while receiving a so-called stimulus that is a fraction of the trillions spent. They hated President Trump and called him a dictator, yet Biden has written more, quote, executive orders, end quote, in the first 2 months than any of his predecessors. And about that so-called transparency, the only thing transparent is the vacant stare on his face. Did you really vote for this? Signed, Paul Hemmer of Simpson Street in Dubuque. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 1st, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Eileen G. Fisher, age 90, formerly of Dubuque, passed away March 30th at the Urbandale Healthcare Center in Des Moines. The Mass of Christian Burial for Eileen will be noon Monday, April 5th at Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Sherrill, with Father Noah Deem as the celebrant. Visitation will be held before Mass from 10 a.m. until noon. Masks are required, and we ask that you please respect our current social distancing requirements. Burial will be in Saints Peter and Paul Cemetery in Sherrill. The Mass will be live-streamed on Hoffman, Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at www.hskfhcares.com. Eileen was born January 3, 1931, in Sherrill, Iowa, the daughter of Anton and Leona Schuller Stecker. She married Lawrence E. Fisher on June 25, 1955, in Sherrill. He preceded her in death on March 14, 1989. Over her years, she had been employed at Link Photography Studio, Lizer's Supper Club, Xavier Hospital, and then Mercy Hospital, from which she retired. She was longtime member of Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Sherrill. Some of her favorite pastimes included reading, crocheting, sewing, bingo, and traveling. Eileen was a caring sister, wonderful mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Her most cherished times were spent with family. Surviving are her three daughters, Sharon and Jim Downing of Des Moines, Suzanne and Howard Lammy of Altoona, and Maureen and David Dornenball of Des Moines, 6 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. She is survived by her brothers, Noel and Pearl Stecker, Joel and Carol Stecker, her sisters, Loretta Benke, Joyce and Jerry Schmidt, and sister-in-law, Jean Stecker, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. Beside her husband, she was preceded in death by her son, David Fisher, her parents, sisters, Lorraine Arid and Mary Hirsch, brothers, Victor Stecker and Loris Stecker, brothers-in-law, Clem Arid, Alfred Hirsch, and Alfred Benke, and sisters-in-law, Lou Stecker and Susan Stecker. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to the American Diabetes Association. The family wishes to thank the staff at Urbandale Healthcare Center, along with Suncrest Hospice nurses and staff, for their loving care of Eileen. Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of the arrangements. Condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Eileen's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Robert James Schnathman, known as Jim, aged 69, of rural Bellevue, passed away on January 25, 2019, in the compassionate care of Compass Regional Hospice in Chestertown, Maryland. Jim was born to William and Marion Matthews Schnathman in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on May 7, 1949. The second of 5 siblings, Jim's love of the outdoors took shape early on and was embraced as he earned the rank of Eagle Scout. At the same time, he honed his skills in track and field, excelling in the pole vault. After attending college in Indiana and a stint in the U.S. Navy, he found his way to rural Illinois to work on his uncle's farm. There he learned about the stewardship of land, which led him to his longtime home of Bellevue, Iowa. Jim was a skilled stone and brick mason, specializing in historical restoration. He operated his business, called Rock Steady, for decades. When he wasn't restoring old structures, he could be found handcrafting wood furniture, gardening, grafting trees, canning, making maple syrup, volunteering for Dubuque City Youth Ballet, or just watching the world go round at his beloved homestead while enjoying a dab beer and a cigar with his trusty canine sidekick, Cletus. He collected antiques and oddities and especially enjoyed crockery and gargoyles and had an extensive collection of records. Jim enjoyed spending time with family and the many friends he made over the years. He truly was one of a kind in every sense of the word. He had a sharp wit and unique sense of humor. Jim is survived by his two sons, Hickory and Tricia Clark Snaithman of Bucksport, Maine, and their son, Mason, and Ryder and Amanda Conklin Snaithman of Chestertown, Maryland, and their daughter, Lumen, siblings, David Degg and Karen Snaithman, John Skip and Peggy Snaithman, Marilyn Duchess and Bob Boone, Joanne Babe and Kurt Adams, five nieces and one nephew. A potluck memorial gathering will be held from 12 to 2 p.m. Saturday, May 1st, at the Lodge at the Nelson Unit, Bellevue State Park. Feel free to bring a side dish or your beverage of choice. Please invite any friends who may enjoy sharing their memories of Jim. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in Jim's memory to Academy of Ballet, 2085 Mullen Road in Dubuque, Compass Regional Hospital, 160 Corsfall Drive in Centerville, Maryland, 21617, or Louis Body Dementia Association, 9112 Killian Hill Road Southwest in Lilburn, Georgia, 30047. Teresa A. Malloy, age 91, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, March 30th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, April 5th, at Church of the Resurrection, where a funeral mass will be held at 11 a.m. A full obituary will be published in Sunday's Telegraph Herald. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family. In funeral service announcements, included are announcements for Pauline Dressler of Dickeyville, Wisconsin. Visitation, 9 to 10:15 a.m. Thursday, April 8th, at Holy Ghost Church in Dickeyville. Services for Faye A. Francis of Bellevue include graveside services at 10 a.m. today at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery in Bellevue. Services for Lawrence G. Hofer of Cuba City, Wisconsin include visitation from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Monday, April 5th at St. Rose of Lima Church in Cuba City. Funeral services for Lawrence G. Hofer will be 11:30 a.m. Monday at the church. Dorothy H. Kohler of Potosi, Wisconsin, for whom there will be a visitation from noon to 1 p.m. Monday, April 5th at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Tennyson, Wisconsin, with Mass of Christian burial at 1 p.m. Monday at the church. Services for Richard R. Maston of Dubuque include visitation from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, April 3rd, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home on Asbury Road. Funeral service for Richard Maston will be 10 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Services for Ruth G. McElhenney of Dubuque include a gathering from 3 to 5 p.m. today at Sundown Mountain Resort's North Lodge in Dubuque. Services for Robert A. Sargent of Dubuque include a committal service at 1 p.m. Wednesday, May 12th, at the Andrew, Iowa Cemetery. Services for Corrine C. Sauer of Manchester include graveside service at 1 p.m. Friday, April 2nd, at the Coggin Cemetery. Services for Carol J. Swift of Dubuque include visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. Services for Rose M. Werner of Galena, Illinois include visitation from 10 to 11 today at Galena Bible Church. Celebration of Life for Rose Werner will be 11 a.m. today at the church. And that concludes the obituaries and funeral services in today's Telegraph Herald. On the front page of today's sports section is a focus on girls' prep soccer by Tim O'Neill, titled Kicking Off the Rust. A pair of coaches were set to make their debuts last season, one at her alma mater, which she helped lead into the state championship game in the middle of the last decade. But then the sports world stopped at the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, and the area's soccer programs were forced to the sidelines as their seasons were canceled. Now, 2 years after their last high school competition, soccer returns to Eastern Iowa, but the landscape of the sport may look vastly different than when the last goal was scored in 2019. Here's a capsule look at area girls' soccer programs competing in the Mississippi Valley Conference this season. Dubuque Hempstead is led by coach Alicia Duccini in her second season. Their 2019 record was 7-10, with 3-3 in the MVC. Returning starters include Grace Dack, a senior, Jamie Weideman, a senior, Camden Henkels, a junior, and Kaylee Herring, a junior. The outlook? Duccini, a former Hempstead standout who led the Mustangs to the state tournament 3 times during her playing career, will finally get a chance to lead her alma mater on the field after her debut season was canceled. Hempstead has a large group of promising newcomers just because it's been nearly 2 years since the program last played a match. There is a core group of leaders for Duccini to lean on, though. Dak had 2 goals and 4 assists to rank 3rd on the team with 8 points in 2019. She tied for the team lead with 10 goals as a freshman in 2018. Henkels had a goal and an assist, and Herring had 2 helpers in 2019. Dubuque Senior is led by coach Robert Lynch in his second season. Their 2019 was 12-5, having gone 8-2 in the MVC. Returning veterans include Brooke Healy, a senior, Jillian Manternock, also a senior, senior Emma Loney, Reagan Whalen, a senior, Nora Perkins, a junior, Lily Kemp, a junior, and Hannah Mueller, also a junior. The outlook? The Rams put together their best season in a generation in 2019, then saw most of those players graduate over the past 2 summers. But the cupboard isn't completely bare as Lynch opens his first official season in charge. Healy was senior's 2nd leading scorer with 7 goals and 4 assists in 2019, but that is the sum total of returning points for the Rams. A young group with club experience joins the Rams' veterans, and Lynch said the cohesion is already evident. If senior can knock the rust off quickly, senior could be a dark horse contender. Dubuque Wallert is led by coach Jill Leibforth in her 4th season. Their 2019 record was 12-7, going 3-3 in the MVC. Returning starters are Gabby Moran, Maya Wachter, Allie Kutch, Ivy Deerstone, and Lola Grapp. The outlook? The Golden Eagles have a strong group to build this season around, and those athletes have seen success in other sports. Kutch, Moran, and Wachter were part of Wallert's state qualifying basketball team. Moran is also a standout cross-country runner. Grapp was part of the Eagles' bowling team that competed at state, and Deerstone wrestled at the Iowa Girls State Tournament. There will be a gap between the seniors and the underclassmen. Even the sophomores are essentially freshmen after not playing in 2020, but Leibforth has young talent to work with. Getting back into rhythm after a year off will be a challenge, though. Wachter was a 2nd on the team with 13 goals and 7 assists in 2019. Moran added 9 goals and 7 assists, and Grapp had 5 goals and 3 assists. And finally, Western Dubuque, led by coach Cece Zangara in her 16th season. Their 2019 record was 6-12, and they went 2-7 in the Mississippi Valley Conference. Returning starters include Faith Krapfel, a junior, Macy Simon, a senior, and Faith Bauer, also a senior. Their outlook? The Bobcats are brimming with enthusiasm after missing out on all of last season. Western Dubuque, like many other programs, will be lacking experience, but Zangara is hoping the talent on her roster will help offset that youth and allow the Bobcats to rise in the always tough MVC. Digman is the team's top returning scorer after notching 3 goals in 2019. Faith Bauer had 2 goals and 3 assists, and Lyons also had 2 goals. Simon and Davis both had 1 assist. Krapfel returns as the team's top goalkeeper after saving 85.4% of the shots on goal she faced in 2019. This week's Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week is Dawson Fayen. Dawson Fayen is known as the East Dubuque Warriors' silent leader. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week plays offense, defense, and special teams for the Warriors in his 2nd season on the varsity football team. He scored his 2nd kickoff return touchdown of the season last Friday, returning the opening kick 85 yards and added a 45-yard touchdown run in the 2nd quarter as the Warriors improved to 1-1 with a 28-7 victory at Dakota. quote, Dawson loves all the roles on the team, and he works very hard at each of them, end quote, East Dubuque coach Joe Edler said. Quote, he is a quiet kid, but he is a tremendous leader. He is constantly helping out the younger kids, end quote. Fayen said he enjoys each position he plays, but loves being a kick returner the most. Quote, it's just really fun to make a big play, he said. Quote, to do it in back-to-back games was pretty awesome. I never returned a kickoff for a touchdown until this year, end quote. After a summer spent lifting and training for his upcoming junior football season, Fayen recalls the feeling of finding out his season was not going to happen in the fall. Quote, it really sucked when they told us we weren't going to get to play, he said. We all worked so hard all summer long and had really been looking forward to getting to play, so we were all pretty frustrated, end quote. Fayen, who also competes in basketball, track, and cross country, said it wasn't until basketball season that they found out they would be getting a shortened spring football season. Quote, we basically went from our last basketball game one day to football practice the next, he said. We didn't get a lot of time to prepare, but we are all super thankful for the chance to get some games in. Fayen said the first two games have gone well for the Warriors. Quote, no one thought we were going to win a game this year, and we are playing a lot better than what people expected, he said. We are excited to prove some people wrong with the four games we have left, end quote. Although he is only a junior, Fayen is happy to take on a leadership role within the team. Quote, I think that playing last year really gave me a lot of experience, and I'm happy to help out the younger guys as much as I can, he said. Added Edler, quote, he's just a really good kid with good character. The sky is the limit for him, end quote. Today's lifestyle section focuses on the arts. The feature article is by Megan Gloss of the Telegraph Herald and titled When Words Become Dance. Heartland Ballet braces for A Midsummer Night's Dream. A land where mischievous sprites cast magical spells, a queen falls in love with a donkey, and romance abounds in four interconnected plots that take place under an Athens moon during A Midsummer's Night. The Heartland Ballet will bring such enchantment and humor to life with its upcoming production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, set for Friday, April 9th through Sunday, April 11th at Dubuque's Grand Opera House. The ballet, based on one of William Shakespeare's most popular and frequently performed comedies and set to the music of Mendelssohn, stays true to its original interpretation. It's something artistic director Marina O'Rourke said choreographer Megan McLeod meticulously crafted. Quote, Megan has portrayed the story as if Shakespeare's words become dance, O'Rourke said. When we last performed this ballet 10 years ago, we pared it down to more of an idea of the story rather than the actual story. Megan really expanded that to include all of the main characters that the people will be familiar with. And the story, as it's translated on stage, is very clear, end quote. The story's varied subplots surround the marriage of Theseus and Hippolyta, six amateur actors preparing a play to be performed before the wedding and four Athenian lovers. By chance, each find themselves within a forest inhabited by a group of whimsical fairies with playful antics used to manipulate the humans. The overlapping storylines hysterically unfold, thanks to a little fairy dust placed upon the eyes, revealing lovers' sudden infatuation with their unintended and lending truth to such famous lines from the tale as, quote, the course of true love never did run smooth, end quote. It's a true comedy, O'Rourke said. Quote, Megan has been encouraging the dancers to go with their sense of humor and their comic instincts in these roles, end quote. The cast involves approximately 40 dancers. Elizabeth Sigwarth portrays Puck, a good-natured but mischievous sprite who stands out in the story. Quote, Puck has such intense dance movements that aren't exactly the most balletic, O'Rourke said. Quote, Sigwarth has gymnastics training as well, so she has been having a lot of fun bringing that into the role, and she's a wonderful actress, end quote. The couples are played by Nicole Johnson as Titania and Chris Myers as Oberon, Ava Hushler as Hermia, and Mason Yeager as Lysander, Mackenzie Hackett as Helena, and Noah Ripperger as Demetrius, and Petra Bergsma as Hippolyta, and Jackson Wernke as Theseus. Bottom, a donkey who captures the affection of Titania and provides comic relief, is portrayed by guest artist and longtime Dubuque dancer Doug Mackey. Quote, Doug is just amazing, O'Rourke said. Even in a donkey head, he is such a comedian. He does everything with 100% energy. He's a wonderful person for our dancers to be able to work with." End quote. The ensemble is rounded out by a group of four fairies, a firefly, dragonflies, nymphs, waterbugs, pixies, fog fairies, and salamanders. Quote, "It's gorgeous and so colorful," McLeod said. Quote, "Because so many of the characters fall under a spell, it can be confusing. We've color-coded the costuming to make the story very easy to follow." End quote. McLeod, who has studied in classics as well as in dance, said she is leaning on that background for bringing her vision to life on stage. Quote, "It's an interesting mix," she said. "I've always loved this Shakespeare play. Bringing together this magical world of the Greeks with human foibles and politics, in the very beginning we see a young woman being forced to marry. It has been very fun to introduce the dancers to it. For many of them, it's their first engagement with this story." End quote. Performances will be both live and live-streamed, the second such undertaking for the ballet company since the pandemic took hold. The Nutcracker, presented in December with two casts to maximize the safety of the dancers in light of COVID-19, had a similar offering available. Quote, "Many took advantage of the live stream and loved it, and we received a lot of really positive comments," O'Rourke said. "The Grand really has gotten this process down and knows what they are doing in terms of safety precautions. We've also done everything on our end to have proper safety measures in place for our dancers, following all procedures and making sure all dancers are masked. Megan has been coaching the dancers how to act big so we can get a sense of the facial expressions through their masks." End quote. For those planning to attend live, the approximately 70-minute ballet will be performed without an intermission to limit audience congregation. Seating in the Grand also will be limited for adequate social distancing. Masks will be required to be worn for the duration of the performance. Quote, "If people are not familiar with the ballet, it's a wonderful piece to start with," McLeod said. "It's completely accessible, entertaining, very fun, and uplifting. It's a good choice, full of beauty, happiness, love, and spring, things we all kind of want right now." End quote. St. Luke's plans annual observance for Good Friday. St. Luke's United Methodist Church at 1199 Main Street will host its annual Good Friday observance from noon to 3 p.m. Friday, April 2nd. An organ prelude will begin at 11:45 a.m. with the tower chime tolling 33 times to conclude the service. The so-called Seven Last Words service will feature clergy from multiple Dubuque congregations in 20-minute segments and with organ interludes. Included will be at 12:15 the Reverend Tim Bees of First Baptist Church, at 12:35 p.m. the Reverend Tom Schinkel of Grandview United Methodist Church, at 1 p.m. the Reverend Paul Atanasaya of Archdiocese of Dubuque, at 1:25 p.m. the Reverend Stephanie Ells of First Presbyterian Church, at 1:45 p.m. the Reverend Lillian Daniel of First Congregational Church, at 2:10 p.m. the Reverend Derek Rosenstiel of Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, and at 2:30 p.m. the Reverend Stephanie Schlimm of St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Community musicians will include Chuck Barland, Delano Kane Watson, Ann Duchov, Kristen Eby, Sue Hattle, Chris Coleman, Otto Kruger, David Patterson, Keith Rippey, and Heather Williams. A freewill offering will be accepted to support food insecurity in the community through the Church Food for the Soul Weekly Meal and Food Voucher Fund. Masks and social distancing will be required for those in attendance. The event also will be live-streamed at stlukesdbq.org. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, April 1st, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.